This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rebecca Roberts. Senate Democrats are hoping for an early August vote to confirm President Barack Obama's new nominee to the Supreme Court. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at the high court confirmation process. But first, if Elena Kagan is confirmed to a seat on the Supreme Court, it will lead to an Ivy League clean sweep. And not just any Ivy, every justice will have attended law school at either Harvard or Yale. Should a diploma from one of the nation's top two law schools be a prerequisite for a job on the court? NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The rise of the Harvard-Yale hegemony is not new in Washington. Each of the last four presidents passed through these two institutions. Elena Kagan would replace John Paul Stevens, who attended lowly Northwestern University Law School, only number 11 on the U.S. News rankings. Harvard and Yale's half-Nelson grip on entry to the high court is a little odd to some observers, especially those from different time zones. Dan Farber teaches at the seventh-best law school, also known as Berkeley Law.
It does seem kind of weird, for example, that Stanford, which is, you know, ranked right up there with Harvard and Yale, doesn't have now any of that representation.
The idea that someone from Berkeley would complain about a slight against arch-rival Stanford shows just how surprised some Westerners are about their total shutout from the court. Stanford, ranked number 3, sent both William Rehnquist and Sandra Day O'Connor to the high court. Author Nicholas Lemon says the Harvard-Yaleification of the court marks a resurgent elitism in American society.
It really represents an unstated but quite powerful consensus that there's a narrow channel through which you have to pass to be a Supreme Court justice.
Lemon says the Kagan nomination points to a growing lack of diversity when it comes to background and experience. He says this cautious strategy dictates,
if they haven't done certain things by the time they're 25 or 30, game over.
Gone are the days, Lemon says, when experience in politics, as with former California Governor Earl Warren, was seen as a gateway to the court. Others look at the Harvard-Yale nexus and say, so what? Professor Pamela Carlin of Stanford Law says your education resume just isn't that important in the final analysis.
I don't think anybody is nominated for the Supreme Court because of what they did as a child.
Elena Kagan graduated from Harvard way back in 1986, although since then she served as law school dean there from 2003 to 2009, so her ties to that school are awfully strong. Still, Pam Carlin says we shouldn't make too much of what is essentially a coincidence.
Graduates of elite universities do all sorts of things in their professional careers, just as graduates of not particularly selective law schools often go on to elite positions.
And many observers say the Harvard-Yale pedigree is just a safety net that helps preempt potential criticism of a nominee's bona fides. And the truth is, using top schools as a filter makes life simpler for busy presidents and for Supreme Court justices when they choose their clerks. Justice Antonin Scalia, Harvard class of 1960, admitted as much in an address last year when he said his favorite court clerk was Jeff Sutton, whom he inherited from Justice Lewis Powell.
Well, I wouldn't have hired Jeff Sutton. For God's sake, he went to Ohio State.
Scalia wasn't being ironic. He said he believed the best schools admit the best and the brightest. The chief flaw with the Yale-Harvard test is that it leaves out people who couldn't get into those schools, which is to say, most of us. In 1970, Senator Roman Hruska defended High Court nominee G. Harold Carswell against the charge that he was mediocre. Hruska said, there are a lot of mediocre judges and people and lawyers. They're entitled to a little representation, aren't they? Apparently, they are not. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
Back in 2005, a comedy troupe from Berkeley, California, started to post videos of their sketches to the internet. The group's called The Lonely Island, and they attracted the attention of one of Hollywood's most powerful talent agencies. Now, within weeks, United Talent Agency signed the group, and the rest, well, take a listen.
Lazy Sunday, wake up in the late afternoon. Call Parnell just to see how he's doing.
Hello,
what up, Parnell?
Yo, Sandberg, what's cracking?
You thinking what I'm thinking?
Party up,
man, it's happening.
Lonely Island's crew is behind this video. It's called Lazy Sunday. It aired on Saturday Night Live as a digital short. And its star, Andy Samberg, is quite possibly the biggest name in comedy who was first discovered over the internet.
Their Lazy Sunday viral video hit really sparked a lot of questions within our agency about what the web can bring to the world of talent.
That's Jason Nadler. He's an agent with UTA. Now, normally guys like Nadler deal with the traditional movie stars. UTA represents stars like Harrison Ford and Gwyneth Paltrow. But 4 years ago, the agency decided to start an online division. The idea? To mine the internet, places like YouTube and MySpace, for raw, unvarnished talent. I sat down with Nadler this past week at UTA's Beverly Hills office, where he's now the head of its online division.
The world of internet memes is fleeting fancy, followed by far less sustainable attention. And if I want to sign somebody, they have to have a career in them. I'm here to usher careers, not necessarily ride a singular internet meme.
How do you know what is talent and what's just a great one-off internet video?
I mean, it's a visceral feeling. There's nothing I can necessarily pinpoint other than this is something that's A, intrinsically interesting or marketable, or just really compelling.
To be a celebrity on TV and to get gigs here in Los Angeles and Hollywood, that is a fickle business. We know that. Is the online part of it even more fickle? Is the audience even more distracted?
I would actually say no. You see a number of really engaged audiences that are completely loyal to the personalities that have developed on YouTube.
And who are some of those names?
Justine.
Who does she? What does she do?
Justine is this phenomenally talented, and she'd be proud if I said geeky, woman who is consumed by all things digital. She loves gadgets. Because she's so tied to this tech world that is eager to hit both a female demographic that's very elusive, also fans of, you know, she's very attractive and has ardent male followers as well, so it's not really such a keyed-in demo, but young technology geeks is a huge profit center.
So she can advertise on her
site. Yeah, I mean, I'll pull up her
Yeah,
her
let's
site.
Take a look.
So this is her personal site, but you see all the YouTube is embedded.
And is that her?
This is her.
What is going on? That's her posing in the swimsuit?
She was in Maxim, yeah.
Okay.
Hi, so I want to show you this little thing called Square. This little device will allow you to accept credit card payments right from your iPhone. So let me show you how to use this. The first thing that you have to do is launch the Square application.
So that's an example of her really explaining a product.
So she is obviously incredibly charismatic.
Yes.
This is one of your clients. How easy is it to get to that point now? It's not easy. It's not easy.
No.
So it's not like it's so democratized that anybody can conceivably have a chance to be represented by Jason Nadler.
I think it has a lot more to do with YouTube's algorithmic fancy of the day than anything else at this point.
Because some of these videos have 26 million hits, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to call them and say, I want to represent you.
No. I mean, Justine, you can see, you know, she has acting ambition. She would die to be on a television show as a legit scripted actress. This is a new world, and it's a lot of entrepreneurialism. And by combining that with this sort of understanding of what Hollywood can offer to sort of blossom that entrepreneurialism, those are the kind of people that I'm really looking for.
So it's not like you're finding someone every day and signing a new person up.
I definitely see something interesting every day.
Can you show me a couple of interesting things that you've seen in the last couple weeks?
Yeah, I'll show you what I sent to my music department today.
So what are you typing in now?
Typing in Lady Gaga, Sixth Grader, Paparazzi.
Okay. What is it? Describe what it is.
It's a young, I would say, Justin Bieber-esque, or certainly Justin Bieber-haircutted young man.
Claiming to be a sixth grader.
Who says he's a sixth grader. I tend to believe him. Playing a piano in front of a stunned group of girls.
I think it's a school rehearsal.
And
he's going to perform Lady Gaga's Paparazzi. All right. This is incredible, and this was probably just filmed with a little flip camera.
Right, or his parents or something.
You saw this, and what did you do with this?
Well, I said, okay, this is really incredible.
It's incredible.
And I clicked onto his page, which is the sort of next step of what I do, and I see what else he's done. And I was really actually impressed with his own songs that he sings.
Oh, he actually does his own songs, too.
Yeah, and so even if you look at that now, you know, when I first looked at it, Stars and Broken Hearts had tens of thousands of views. Yeah.
So this kid is clearly talented.
Very talented.
But you wouldn't sign somebody like this because you don't deal with music.
I don't particularly deal with music, but, you know, as a full-service agency, we have a wonderful music department, and the first thing I did was forward it to the agents downstairs.
Because there's a pretty good chance that someone else is going to contact this kid.
Oh, I guarantee people have already contacted him. I'm not the only one surfing the web in this town, that's for sure.
Yeah, but that's a lot. I mean, you've got to be working fast.
You have to work smart more than fast.
What would he have had to have done before YouTube was available to get your attention?
He would probably have had to have moved to Hollywood with his mother and
gone to talent shows or gone to casting calls.
Yeah, it's a new day. And, you know, this is an evolving business. The way that that young man capitalizes on his newfound success, there's not a real recipe for it yet. And I'm helping to try and concoct what constitutes long-term success so these people have real careers.
Well, Jason Adler, thank you so much for your time. Jason Adler is the head of UTA Online here in Beverly Hills. Jason Adler, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It was fun to show you around the web.
And you can find links to the videos Jason Adler played for me, including this Lady Gaga spinoff by Grace and Chance of Edmond, Oklahoma, at our website, npr.org.
If you have in your acquaintance a kid between, say, 8 and 14 or so, you've probably seen them reading The Lightning Thief or another book in the Percy Jackson series by Rick Riordan. It seems possible, in fact, that at any given time, every American fourth grader is reading about Percy Jackson, an ordinary kid who discovers he's actually half a Greek god. That series topped out at 5 books, but author Rick Riordan, who is now hailed as a rock star by middle schoolers, has just published the first book in a new series. The book is called The Red Pyramid, and this time the kids involved are connected to Egyptian mythology. Rick Riordan joins me now from the studios of Louisville Public Media in Kentucky. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So I took my kids to see you at Politics and Prose here in Washington, D.C., and I couldn't get over the size of the crowd and the enthusiasm of the crowd. Are you getting used to being a rock star?
A rock star to middle schoolers. That's something I never thought I would hear about
myself.
Yeah,
it's you and the Jonas Brothers.
It was a great event. And yeah, we've had turnouts like that across the country for the Red Pyramid Tour. It's just been fantastic. Whether I'm getting used to it or not, that's another question. But it is a lot of fun to see the kids come out and get excited about a book.
So the Red Pyramid is the first in what will be a series about the Cain kids, Carter and Sadie. Are you having fun with Egyptian mythology?
Oh, it's great. And, you know, one thing I've learned is you have to listen to kids. As I toured the country for Percy Jackson, so many young readers said, why don't you do something about Egypt? And as a former classroom teacher myself, I knew that it was a very high interest subject. So after thinking about it for a few years, I thought this would be wonderful if I could bring those old myths that aren't as well known as the Greek myths into the present with a Percy Jackson type spin. And that's when I started working on The Red Pyramid. And it's been a wonderful experience. I so enjoy seeing the excitement levels that the kids are having about the Greek and now Egyptian mythology.
The Red Pyramid is the first in the Cain Chronicles. Carter and Sadie Cain are brother and sister. They're 14 and 12, respectively. You know, that's an age when most kids, I would venture to guess, feel like they don't fit in for one reason or another. And these kids, first of all, they're half Egyptian god, but also they, you know, they're half African-American, half white. They have sort of real-world problems as well as these fantasy problems. Is it hard to strike that balance between something that's an adventure for kids to read, but also characters that they'll identify with?
I think actually the two things go together very well, and I think that's one reason why fantasy and why mythology appeals so strongly to kids in those middle grades. You know, being a middle school teacher, I see this all the time. Kids are struggling with their identity. They're struggling with how they fit in with their peers. They're struggling with how they fit in with their families and what their relationship to their parents is. And so to throw a fantasy in there where they're having to deal with all of these issues that normal kids deal with, but in a fantasy setting, I think that really resonates strongly with young readers.
How do you feel about the inevitable Harry Potter comparisons?
Well, you know, I love Harry Potter, and Harry Potter opened so many doors for young adult literature. It really did convince the publishing industry that writing for children was a viable enterprise. And it also, I think, convinced a lot of people that kids will read if we give them books that they care about and they love. I am very optimistic about children. I don't see them turning off to books. In fact, the opposite. I see so much excitement about so many authors out there, and I'm lucky enough to be one of them. I think children love reading, and they will make time for it if we put the right books into their hands, and I hope that I'll get the chance to keep being one of the people that writes them.
Those early teen years, they can be tough. You know, they can be tough on the kids. They can be tough on the parents who might think some malicious Egyptian monster is possess their children. You clearly have a gift for reaching this age group. What advice do you have for parents?
Well, you know, the best thing that I've found is just to provide a time for kids to read. And it doesn't so much matter what they're reading. Rather, we just need to give them a time in the day when the family's sitting down, and I do this at my home with my kids, and it's an expectation that we're all going to read together. I'll pick up my novel, and they'll pick up their novel, and we'll spend an hour just with books. It's so important to model reading, because if the parents are too busy to read, then the children are going to feel like they're too busy to read as well. Beyond that, encourage their interest. Strike up a good relationship with your children's librarian. They are a wealth of information for good books. Find a good independent bookseller in your community. They're another great source of information. And find the books that engage your child. Every child is different. And I think that's important, that we don't have maybe just one or two books that we're recommending to all children, but rather we cater the books to fit each individual child.
That family reading time sounds suspiciously like a plan for you to get another chapter read in your own book.
It's true. My own sons are my first editors, and they are always the first ones to hear the manuscript. It's a really great part of my editing process, because if I write a joke that I think is hysterical and they don't laugh, I know that joke has to be cut.
Rick Riordan, his new book is called The Red Pyramid. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can read an excerpt from The Red Pyramid at our website, npr.org. The ongoing oil spill in the Gulf is also threatening the livelihoods of thousands of fishermen. But as Phoebe Judge of Mississippi Public Broadcasting reports, one small community in Biloxi is especially worried.
It's a quiet morning at Lee's Market in Biloxi, and manager Vivi Wen has just arrived at work and is surveying the aisles.
We have all different type of tofu. They have fried tofu, spiced tofu, fresh tofu.
At any one time, the market carries over 20,000 items from Southeast Asia. Wen says that helps them serve their customer base, which is 90% Vietnamese, many of whom are fishermen. The market is also a gathering spot for the latest news, and lately, that news has been dominated by talk of oil. Even though the oil spill has not reached Mississippi, the threat looms large. Kiet Nguyen is with the Vietnamese social service agency Boat People SOS.
That is enormous how they reacted to the oil spill. The main thing was just, what am I going to do? Because this is my livelihood. If it's not shrimp, what can I do?
Many Vietnamese began immigrating to Mississippi and other Gulf states in the early 1980s, drawn by the opportunity to work on the water, says Magda Lalo. She's been working with the Vietnamese community for 19 years as program director of the Migration and Refugee Center in Biloxi.
We attracted shrimpers, fishermen. This is really a profession where they feel comfortable, because it reminds them so much of Vietnam. That's what those were doing, you know, those who came here to the coast.
Vietnamese-owned shrimp and fishing boats are often completely crewed by fellow Vietnamese, creating a tight-knit community. Ginny Tran's father came from Vietnam to work on a shrimp boat in Biloxi before she was born. She now works for the National Alliance Vietnamese American Service Agencies and helps provide microloans to Vietnamese shrimpers and crabbers.
It's kind of a joke is if your last name is Tran Nguyen and you're Catholic, 75% of the time I'm related to you.
Tran and others are working with the community to learn how last month's oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico will affect them. They push to have the information provided by oil officials in Vietnamese and not just English. And last week, more than 100 Vietnamese fishermen packed into the D'Iberville Civic Center to hear a BP proposal about how they could be paid to help BP clean up the oil spill. Jackie Hsu and her husband have been shrimping in Biloxi for 30 years. She says they're angry and feel that BP owes them.
If the boat cannot go out for shrimping, they need to give us an opportunity to work.
Last year's shrimping season was especially bad for many Biloxi fishermen. Prices were low, and they faced increased competition from imported shrimp.
It's harder and harder every day.
And the fear now is those difficult days may become even worse if engineers can't plug the leaks, spewing thousands of barrels of oil into the Gulf each day. For NPR News, I'm Phoebe Judge in Gulfport, Mississippi.
BP says it's now funneling crude oil from a well deep under the Gulf of Mexico into an oil tanker at the surface. Late last night, company engineers successfully attached a mile-long tube to the source of the leak. But ocean researchers are now starting to come back with initial data, and much of it is grim. Massive plumes of oil, some of them 10 miles long and 300 feet thick, are now suspended in the Gulf. Vernon Asper, a professor of marine science at the University of Southern Mississippi, is part of a team of scientists collecting data and samples of the water from the research vessel Pelican, and he joins me on the line from the boat. Vernon Asper, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Describe these plumes of oil that you're finding. How big are they, and what do they look like?
We can't tell you what they look like because we haven't yet gotten a camera down there. That's one of our next immediate objectives, to see how big the particles are, what color they are, and all of that. What I can tell you is what we know about their size and their extent. It looks like they are, at the most, 4 or 5 miles wide, and they are roughly 10 or 15 miles long. The difference between these plumes at depth and the oil at the surface is the oil at the surface is pretty much two-dimensional. It has a length and a width, no depth, because it's floating right on the surface. These plumes at depth have a thickness, and many of them are more than 100 meters thick. Mm. And so because of that, we're trying to map them in three dimensions, and that's a rather tedious process.
Do you have a sense of how many of these plumes are out there?
We've detected, at most places, three of them. One is at 700 meters, one's roughly 1,000, and one's down around 1,300 meters of depth. And that's way down there. So it's very possible that these plumes could drift around and actually impinge on the seafloor at some point.
So they're like these sort of suspended islands inside of the ocean.
That's right. And you can think of the plumes the same way you would think of the ash cloud from a volcano. It rises up off the seafloor, it reaches a level in the ocean where it's no longer buoyant, and then it spreads out and is simply carried by the prevailing wind, in this case in the ocean, is prevailing currents, and they take them which way they're going. And it turns out in this case, the currents happen to be going to the southwest.
Now, you have taken some samples. I understand you have a jar of some of that material with you?
I do. Right now, I'm looking at a used soft drink bottle that we got from the surface, and we just grabbed some water off the surface that had oil in it. At the top of it is about a centimeter of very, very dark oil. It just looks like the oil you drain out of your car. Below that's clear water, and then on the bottom of the bottle, there are very dark particles of something or other, and we don't know what those particles are. We're going to take a look at them, but what it illustrates is that some of the oil floats and some of it doesn't. There's also sort of an unknown here, and that is the effect of the dispersants. We don't know what the dispersants are really doing to this deep oil. It's possible that they will affect the way these plumes act. And in fact, these plumes could be the result of them adding dispersants already.
We're reading that these plumes are depleting oxygen that's dissolved in the water and could quite possibly create dead zones inside the ocean. Have you seen any evidence of that yet?
Well, they're definitely consuming the oxygen. We see low oxygen associated with the plumes. There's no question about that. Now, is this going to be critically low, low enough to impact the things that live down there? That's something we just can't answer.
How do you get rid of these plumes?
The very best thing probably is to let nature take its course. Aside from the effect of the dispersants, there are microbes in the deep sea that are designed to consume oil. That's what they do. That's what they rely on. Those microbes will find this oil, and they will decompose it.
Vernon Asper, what will you and the scientists aboard the Pelican be looking at in the coming days and weeks?
The first thing we're going to do is analyze our data and analyze the samples. And, of course, we're planning our next cruises. We're already making inquiries into finding ship time. It turns out that the limiting factor for studying this plume is the availability of research vessels. The research fleet in the United States for academic purposes has been dwindling over the last few decades, and there just aren't ships available. So we're having a hard time getting access to vessels that can take us out there.
That's Vernon Asper. He's a professor of marine sciences at the University of Southern Mississippi. We reached him aboard the research vessel Pelican. Vernon Asper, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been a privilege.